I'll have you know the contents of that dumpster are private. You stick your nose in, you'll be violating attorney dumpster confidentiality.
I just wanted to say hello.
Oh. Hello.
All right, we're done.
You think the language in the Second Amendment is clear enough? You know, about the right to bear arms?
Of course it's clear. Every American has the right to hang a pair of bear arms on their wall. How could that possibly be misconstrued?
All right, fantastic then. Wait, you know what? Before we send this to the printer, let's take that abortion thing out.
Oh, come on. I move for a hearing on the matter.
What? You want me to have a special motion on the admissibility of the word asshole?
Well, let me have ass then. That's close enough.
What law school did you go to?
I'll agree to it, Your Honor.
You will? Why?
I don't want any interlocutory appeals.
What are you, a comedy team?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that breaks down the law behind all the news stories you care about. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hey, OA listeners. This is episode 693. I'm Liz Dye, and with me is Andrew Torres. How are you doing today?
Hey, Liz, I am extremely grateful, as I have said on multiple occasions, that you are here, and in particular, that you read Truth Social so I don't have to. How are you doing today?
Well, I've read quite a bit of Truth Social, so I'm doing okay. But actually, I'm better than Donald Trump because he is flipping shit over on Truth Social about radical left Trump-hating special prosecutor Jack Smith.
Yeah, lifelong Republican. Yeah, keep going.
Sorry. Okay. Apparently, Smith is, quote, going absolutely crazy trying to nab the political candidate who is way ahead of his, quote, boss in the polls and won the 2020 presidential election, except for the fact that it was rigged.
You know, I love that you're covering the TrumpTruth.social. Yeah, we really need for you to. Yeah. but we really, really need for you to develop a Trump impression. Right. It would help when, you know, reading to differentiate.
Yeah. Like if Trump was a 5'2" Jewish lady from Baltimore. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, Trump is a little pressed at the moment about a potential presidential run by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He says, all the fake news is reporting that I spend large amounts of my time coming up with a good, quote, nickname for Ron DeSanctimonious, who is obviously going to give the presidential, quote, thing a shot. They are all 100% wrong. I don't even think about it. A very unimportant subject to me, with 3 exclamation points. Please don't let them write in the paper that I got mad.
I have to laugh because otherwise I would cry. I mean, this is someone who won the presidency after, in a debate with the most qualified presidential candidate in modern history, was called out for being Vladimir Putin's puppet and responded with, no puppet, puppet, no puppet, you're the puppet.
Yeah. Well, that happened.
Yeah, that happened.
Anyway, so I'm going to give you a little Andrew was right, though, to make your day a little better, and a little Liz was wrong. Because while we're talking about Trump's, you know, janky Truth Social media platform, I may or may not have said, no one cares about that Raylan Brunson case to overturn the 2020 election and award those plaintiffs, whatever, $11 trillion tax-free. Who even remembers? It was something ridiculous. But in fact, President No Puppet himself flogged the story himself this week twice.
Just in time for SCOTUS to throw it in the trash can tomorrow. I mean, that's why we had to make sure it dropped on the Thursday show. I really do think if you're trying to deprogram Uncle Frank, each one of these, hey, Uncle Frank, remember when you absolutely believed X was going to happen and Trump told you it was going to happen and nothing close to that ever happened? You know, just kind of puts a stone in their shoe. It's a think globally, act locally. We try to get back on the path to sanity. So I'm scared to ask, but Liz, how did Trump fall for the Raylan Brunson lawsuit thing?
Okay. It did not come by his good buddy, Roger Stone, who has been flogging it. And I will spare you the entire backstory. But if anybody remembers John Solomon, the reporter at The Hill, who was secretly working with Rudy Giuliani to launder lies about Biden in Ukraine, that guy got shoved out the door, after which The Hill promised to go forth and only do real journalism henceforth and in perpetuity. That was some more coughing there. Solomon now runs this outfit called Just the News, which is like if the Gateway Pundit went to a couple semesters of J school. And that is where Trump is getting brain poisoned on this Brunson stuff. So congrats, dude. You're totally relevant. And by you, I mean you with your Brunson story.
It was even scarier than my guess, which was just, you know, because it's in Trump's self-interest to believe this and he talks himself and everything.
Right. Well, okay. In the meantime, actual news keeps breaking and we will have updates for you on our Monday show on the New York Times Politico briefing on executive privilege and on E. Jean Carroll. Mm-hmm. And we also owe you guys Patreon bonuses, which are coming. But first, let's talk a little bit about the grand jury report excerpts, which were released today in Fulton County, Georgia. Andrew, what did we learn here?
Yeah, so lots of people are going to say that this is a nothing burger in the sense that it is a formal introduction with some legalese, a formal conclusion with some legalese, and the part eight that we mentioned at the beginning of the week is two short sentences that are less than four lines of text.
Yeah, I read it. I did not think it was a nothing burger, although I was a little alarmed because it looked like page nine was the conclusion, which meant that there weren't that many pages.
Yeah.
You know, it does have an appendix with the statutes, but that was a little alarming. Anyway, go ahead. Tell us what you think.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good point. And I think if you are fly-specking this, we did learn a couple of other things as you kind of read this carefully. So in that introduction section, we learned that the grand jury heard testimony and or received documents from 75 different witnesses over the course of 7 months. So, you know, I when we have said the wheels of justice churn slowly, I mean, it's because this is a pretty straightforward case, and it looks like they had to sift through a mountain of evidence.
Yeah. They clearly did a very capable job, a thorough job, and they did praise the district attorneys that they worked with and said that they were really credible. So I thought it was pretty respectable.
Yeah, I agree with that. Also, in the introduction, we learned, and this is worth a quote, even though it is coming as no surprise to opening arguments listeners, quote, "We find by unanimous vote that no widespread fraud took place in the Georgia 2020 presidential election that could result in overturning that election," end of quote, which we all knew, but good to see in print. That Section 8 is significant. It does not name names, which makes me sad, Lindsey Graham. But it does say that the special purpose grand jury, quote, "believes that perjury may have been committed by one or more witnesses testifying before it," hence my foreshadowing, "and recommends that DA Fonnie Willis," quote, "seek appropriate indictments for such crimes where the evidence is compelling," end of quote. And again, indicting someone for perjury is rare. So, you know, I can't wait to see the rest of the report.
Yeah, I also was hoping that it would say Lindsey Graham. But I think that there's probably plenty of perjury to go around. Although, you know, as you say, people who watch Law and Order maybe think that there's a lot more perjury prosecution than there is, which would be to say that there is any perjury prosecution. I mean, I wouldn't put any money on that one.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I don't anticipate Fonnie Willis indicting anyone specifically and only for the crime of perjury before the grand jury. It might get added on to an omnibus indictment, right, of someone who, any former president that Trump
or
didn't
anybody
testify.
At all. Yeah,
right. but I agree with you. I mean, that's not a crime that gets prosecuted separately. But I think that it is significant that it rose to such a level, right? Because remember, you know, grand juries, juries in general are there to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses. And, you know, you can say, well, we didn't believe X witness, but to say in print, hey, we think this person came in, lied to us, and, you know, if you can see your way clear to arresting them, that would be awesome. Yeah. That says a lot. So,
and they also seem to be very hot for there to be, they kind of signed an omnibus permission slip. They said, if we missed anything, because we're not law lawyers or, you know, election law experts, if we missed anything, please add it on to the tab and arrest everybody for anything else you can think of, DA Fonnie Willis, which was pretty interesting.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Like that, and that's in the conclusion. And when you say that, if we've missed our list of crimes, like, that strongly suggests that in the pages we haven't seen, they do in fact list a lot of crimes.
Yeah, and I would just like to add from our little Truth Social bin, Trump had a long, you know, word vomit salad that he usually does, talking about the you know, and saying that they didn't even mention President Trump's name because President Trump did nothing wrong in these two perfect phone calls. So that was nice. But then he had a shorter one. I guess he remembered he had to, like, channel Bill Barr. And he said, thank you to the special grand jury in the great state of Georgia for your patriotism and courage. Total exoneration. The USA is very proud of you. So, you know, scot-free, buddy.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, so that's that. Not quite a nothing burger, but we're still waiting.
Yeah, but Trump has been a little bit out of sorts, partly because of that, and partly because of the two grand juries being run by Special Counsel Jack Smith to investigate January 6th and Trump's document retention. And last week we talked about this, earlier this week when the New York Times guy said that Smith was going pedal to the metal. They were not kidding.
Yeah, I mean, we're doing four shows a week and we can't keep up.
Right. So we talked about this Tuesday in episode 691 that Smith wants to wrap this thing up by the summer, which does seem crazy ambitious. But he is going hell for leather and pulling in everyone as a witness, although not apparently Mike Pence, because Mike Pence is a senator now or whatever. We talked about it. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And I've come around to your position on that. And the only thing I would add is that Pence could have shown up voluntarily, right? Like, this is not executive privilege. He didn't have to make the speech or debate clause argument. That only applies to him, right? Like, executive privilege, you could maybe argue, you know, well, it's shared by Trump and I felt honor bound to. No, this is just him in his unique role as the vice president. And he would rather hide behind that than, you know, help us figure out who sent a mob armed with a gallows trying to hang him. So, yeah, he's a villain here. Don't forget it.
Yeah, although he's certainly standing up there and making that smell a fart face, like, you know, he does. I mean, I'm sorry to be a little rude, but, like, come on, you know what I'm talking about, where he's like, well, I have to protect the Constitution. And people are like, you know, you could just show up. You don't have to. You're not going to be compelled. The speech or debate clause says you can't be compelled, but you could show up. And he makes that, you know, he wrinkles his brow, or he would if he wasn't full of Botox. Anyway, let us leave Mike Pence for a moment.
I want to sidebar that for 8 seconds, and that is that if you were to take that at face value, he is making it worse, right? Because this is the worst possible case for any president of the Senate to ever try and litigate the scope of executive privilege of the speech or debate clause privilege. And if he truly believed he was doing it for the country, he would say, okay, I'm going to spare you this terrible one. So he's even lying about that.
Oh, I mean, he's such a liar. But
sorry,
I
mean, didn't mean to interrupt.
Not a bit. Let's leave that lying ass liar for a second, though. And let's talk about Mark Meadows. Trump's former chief of staff, who got a subpoena from the January 6th grand jury sometime in January, CNN has reported. Although the article notes that Meadows was one of Trump's designees to the National Archives. So it's entirely possible that he could get an invitation to that party as well. Popular man. All right. So remember, Meadows started off by cooperating with the January 6th committee. He handed over hundreds of his texts, including those with his BFF Ginny Thomas and half the hosts of Fox News. And then he did an about face and refused to go on with the exercise. And 5 minutes after that, Trump's Save America PAC gave $1 million to his employer, the Conservative Partnership Institute. Huh.
Yeah. And to be clear, this is not just grift. It is also the Conservative Partnership Institute is an election denialist think tank that employs, among others, Cleta Mitchell. Right. So he is playing both sides of the street. If Pence is a villain, Mark Meadows is Lex Luthor.
I mean, that's awful generous because, like, ain't that bright? But okay, fine.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, okay. Mark Meadows.
Is there a leader of a group of supervillains that's also an idiot? Cobra Commander. He's Cobra Commander. There we go.
Okay. As I have said, I had friends in high school, so I don't know the answer to that question. But anyway, Mark Meadows, more than anybody, is at the center of this whole January 6th thing.
Isn't that high school when I was watching G.I. Joe? Anyway, I'm sorry.
Were you watching us? Look, no shame, man. No kink shaming here. All right, let's move on. Mark Meadows, more than anybody, is at the center of this whole January 6th thing. He talked to everybody. There is not a single piece of January 6th that he doesn't have his fingerprints on, right? He worked on the fake elector scheme. He was on the call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find that 11,780 votes. And by the way, Meadows already had to testify about that to the Georgia Special Purpose Grand Jury. So, you know, maybe there's a perjury charge in his future. Anyway, Meadows, fingers crossed, he was on the call with the data guys. We talked about this the other day. The data guys that the campaign hired to find that fraud. When the data guys told Trump that there was no fraud, Meadows and Trump kind of flipped shit and said they didn't believe them. Meadows tried to get the Justice Department to investigate a bunch of crazy nonsense, including the Italian space laser theory. He coordinated with the pre-riot rally organizers. He lined up all those treason weasels in Congress to object to swing state electors. He was part of the plan that they all cooked up in advance for Trump to announce that the permitted rally was turning into an unpermitted siege of the Capitol. And he was at the White House all day on January 6th, watching as Trump did not lift a finger to call off his goons. So there's no more essential witness than Mark Meadows. I mean, maybe Pence, but Meadows, no. So it's pretty clear why the special counsel wants to talk to Mark Meadows. And it's clear that a whole lot of what Meadows could say is not remotely privileged. Like, there's no universe in which conversations with the goons at Women for America First or the Trump campaign are covered by executive privilege. And ditto for those conversations with members of Congress. Like, that stuff's definitionally not privileged, which is why Congress referred him for prosecution when he refused to testify about it to the January 6th committee.
That was disappointing that the Department of Justice didn't act on that referral. And I have tried to figure out because, right, in every other respect, the DOJ has been pretty aggressive here. And I guess there are a couple of things that sort of come to mind. One is, it's a little bit of a harder case than Steve Bannon, right? Because he was the current chief of staff and not a former employee at the time. Although, you know, not harder than Peter K. Navarro. But, you know, I mean, Navarro is sui generis, right? Like, he's in his own category there.
I think it's much harder than Bannon. Much, much, much harder than Bannon. No, I mean, I don't mean to interrupt you, but Bannon got fired from the White House in 2017. I mean, Mark Meadows, some of the things that Mark Meadows could testify about, he does have a more than a colorable claim, an absolute claim of privilege. I mean, some of them he doesn't.
Well, I mean, not the crime fraud stuff.
But I mean, there are things for which he absolutely has a claim of privilege. There's a lot of stuff that he doesn't have. I mean, there is nothing. There is a null set of information that Bannon could testify to, which could have a claim of privilege attached to it.
Right.
I disagree with you there. I mean, and Navarro also had a claim of privilege that he could have made. He just didn't, right? He just didn't show up. He gave two fingers to the committee and said, you know, like, you have to work it out with Trump. And they were like, that's not how any of this goes.
No, I think that's right. And I don't disagree with you at all with respect to that. At a distance, I mean, you almost have to admire, I mean, but for the evil, the way in which Mark Meadows has really, you know, threaded the needle here, right? Like, he went the entire January 6th committee. And as, you know, as we pointed out on the show, the January 6th committee never once called him out the way you so eloquently called him out, you know, 2 minutes ago, right? That they sort of talked about it and mentioned that he was on documents, but that they didn't point their fingers at him the way they pointed their fingers at other people that were, you know, less good at it, like one Dr. John Eastman.
I don't think that Meadows played this particularly intelligently. I mean, he was cooperating. If you were playing this smart, would you give them your texts with half of Congress and, you know, the Supreme Court justices? Like, that wasn't a strategic decision. That was him flailing around. So I don't think that he played it smart. I mean, I think he played it smart enough not to get indicted. Look, here's a comparable thing, because actually Bannon and Navarro made reference to this, because they tried to say we're being unfairly prosecuted because Congress made referrals for both Meadows and Scavino to be prosecuted for contempt of Congress. And Scavino is kind of a better parallel. That Scavino didn't have all of this hamleting back and forth, like, I am going to cooperate, I'm not going to cooperate, right? Like, he just kind of didn't, but he had his lawyer do it, and he engaged enough. He had enough of a colorable claim because he was Trump's comms manservant, basically, that he, you know, I mean, like, he literally used to be Trump's golf caddy, and he was, you know, he holds Trump's phone and sends out stupid tweets. But okay, he's there in the room all the time. So Scavino had a colorable claim of privilege, and he engaged just enough with the committee to avoid being prosecuted, you know, for whatever reason by the Justice Department. So if you're talking about somebody who played it smart, Scavino played it smart. Meadows, you know, flopped around and gave them all his texts. Like, that's not smart. I don't think that's smart at all, but, you know, whatever.
No, you've persuaded me on that as well.
Okay. See, we're making progress here. So Meadows has been subpoenaed. What is not clear to me is if Meadows has been talking to the prosecutors leading up to this, and if this is like the culmination of that, and now he's going to say it for the grand jury so that they'll be able to put his information in a presentment, or this is the beginning of a protracted fight. I mean, I expect it's the beginning of a protracted fight. I expect that he's going to make some assertions of privilege and kind of try and string this out for another 2 years in hopes that Trump or God knows who, Josh Hawley, is back in the White House. Ron DeSantis, like whoever would happily bone this investigation. But, you know, there's a possibility that he's been talking to them this whole time. He's got representation. I think he has George Terwilliger. So I don't know. What do you think?
I believe that's correct. Yeah. No, I too would like to be an optimist on this, but given Meadows to date, given the CPI, I still have him kind of strongly in the villain camp. And I think you're probably, you know, on the, I would place my wager on the latter of those two options. How about that?
Girl, same. All right. Let's talk about this in a little bit. We're going to go to ad and we'll be right back. And if we are in for a protracted fight about these subpoenas, there's apparently a lot of fight going on already. CNN has another article about all the ongoing special counsel grand jury kerfuffling at the moment. And apparently there's quite a lot. And I would just like to take a second to shout out CNN's Caitlin Pollens and Casey Gannon, who are the undisputed queens of the stakeout at the federal courthouse in D.C. Like, you're not getting in either one of those grand jury rooms without these ladies spotting you. So do not even try. Yeah. So yesterday, Pollens, Gannon, and also reporter Evan Perez had a long post about these pending legal fights. They broke some interesting news. According to their reporting, there are at least 8 secret battles going on at the U.S. District Court and Circuit Court in D.C. And remember, these filings are under seal because they're pertaining to grand juries, and grand juries are secret. Well, they're secret from everyone but CNN, who, by the way, spotted former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien at the courthouse this morning, as we are recording on Thursday, and he was set to testify before one or both of the special counsel's grand juries, the documents grand jury and the January 6th grand jury, both of which are in session today. And he could be at both, because NSA. Yeah. He has to do with documents, too.
Yeah, although it seems more 1-6, right? Like, he was interviewed by the 1-6 committee and stiffed them. And yeah, Jack Smith, I mean, seems to be making good on that. I'll have this wrapped up by summer, promise. I mean, the nice thing is, you know, we had 2 years of, why hasn't Merrick Garland arrested Donald Trump already? And at least people have stopped asking that.
Yeah. No, I'm good with it. I'm good with it. I don't think it has to go that fast, but like if you're doing it, I'm good.
Yeah, he's obviously doing it.
Right. Interestingly, CNN reveals that Trump is trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube, as it were, regarding some of the witnesses who already testified. Like, so we already discussed this. We discussed that Trump had attempted to assert executive privilege as to Mike Pence's aides Greg Jacob and Mark Short, and Chief Judge Beryl Howell overruled Trump's privilege claim and ordered them to cough it up. Trump appealed to the D.C. Circuit, but my memory is a little fuzzy on this, but I think it was in part due to lack of diligence. He lost there. I think he might have, like, waited too long and they'd already testified. I don't know. I mean, his lawyers are his lawyers. Similarly, there was a similar course of events regarding Trump's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his deputy, Pat Philbin. I wasn't totally sure until this reporting whether they'd actually testified, but apparently Judge Howell made them fess up and overruled their privilege claims as well. Trump has apparently appealed both of those cases to the D.C. Circuit, and I'm sure he'll go to the Supreme Court before there. He has every incentive to deprive the government of evidence it might use to indict him, including, of course, the testimony of people who saw all his crimes firsthand. And he's got infinity grift bucks from the PACs to pay those lawyers, so you know, he doesn't care. There's no skin off his nose. But most importantly, what he wants here, his real goal, is to run out the clock in hopes that he'll be back in office so he can prosecute all of his enemies via firing squad before they can put him in jail. Did you see that in Rolling Stone? You saw that. You saw he wants to bring back group executions by firing squad. Like, what kind of third world dictator shit is this?
Sure. And I, you know, we have to mention it. We both saw it. In a way, I feel like it's feeding the machine, right? Like that Trump has nothing to lose by promising more fascism. And, you know, we're doing him a favor when we repeat it to our liberal audience, right? Because it's a double win for him, right? Yeah. Like his hardcore Nazi base is like, yes, master, you are indeed going to bring back firing squad. And then everybody else who's like an embarrassed Republican that's like, I just want more cuts to the capital gains tax or whatever, like is like, but you know, if you put this to them, you're like, you want more cuts to the capital gains tax and also firing squads, will be like, oh, come on. He's just trolling the libs. And this is not how politics is supposed to work. And, you know, it's why we continue to cover this, right? Like, it's why it's important that there is a public arrest of Donald Trump at a public break and he spends a day in prison and we can just, you know, hopefully move back towards sanity. I'm sorry. I'll get off the soapbox.
I mean, you have an active fantasy life, but I will say that I do not think it's a bad thing to cover this. I mean, so I've been at this for like 6 years. And when I started, I was like, why do we talk about Alex Jones? Why do we talk about QAnon? That's all bullshit. It's just like some corner of the internet and you're just giving that oxygen. And actually, I don't feel that way anymore, but you know, in part because of what happened on January 6th, but you know, for a long time before that, like the ideas that Steve Bannon espouses, and he's tremendously popular, but the ideas of those people, like those people are really into Pinochet and throwing people out of helicopters. Like they print t-shirts that have like helicopters and that's what they mean. Like this isn't so fringe anymore. So on the one hand, yes, this is Donald Trump just like saying crazy shit because he's Donald Trump. But on the other hand, these fascist ideas have made a real comeback. There is a real portion of the population which wants this, which thinks it's good. And I'm not sure that you can say you're giving them oxygen by talking about them now. Like they're here, right? And they have the internet, and the internet is going to feed that into a whole bunch of pissed off, lonely young men's, you know, computers via whatever algorithm, or even if they go looking for it. Like, I don't think that ignoring this problem makes it go away.
I agree with you. I think well stated.
Okay. So we've already discussed the two executive privilege cases for those White House's advisors in the context of the New York Times litigation to shake loose those arguments. Remember, that was the New York Times and Politico sued to get that out. And we'll be talking about that on Monday because there were some other developments this week. But safe bet that if CNN knows about the other executive privilege disputes, the stuff that's coming up, we're going to see more cases trying to unseal those arguments filed soon.
Yeah. And it could be the stuff that is adjacent to Cipollone and Pat Philbin. It could be super interesting.
Totally. Totally. From a legal perspective, are they going to claim anything besides executive privilege? Are they going to claim attorney-client? I mean, who knows, right?
Yeah.
So there's also a pending dispute over Pennsylvania Congressman Scott Perry's cell phone data. Perry is
that guy.
That guy. Right. He is all the way up the ass end of this conspiracy. He appears to be the one who introduced our old pal Jeff Oilspill Clark to Donald Trump. He was instrumental in pushing the fake elector scheme as well as the plan to march on the Capitol. Like, he knew. He was on this call. There were about 17 congressmen. Meadows was also on that call. He's all over Mark Meadows' texts, of course, which is presumably why the FBI seized his phone in August. But they haven't gone through it yet because Perry is saying that he has legislative immunity for his communications under the speech or debate clause. And it's, I guess, more reasonable than Pence in that, you know, he really is a member of Congress. So Judge Howell overruled that claim. We don't know why. Presumably there'll be litigation to shake it loose. But the issue is now stayed pending a ruling from the D.C. Circuit.
Okay. So let me make sure I understand this properly. So far, not even via Taint Team, nobody has reviewed Perry's cell phone.
Correct.
And although he lost on the speech or debate clause, we infer, in front of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, in front of our friend Judge Beryl Howell, that's been appealed to the D.C. Circuit. And in connection with that, I can understand, and even if I were the judge in that case, you would stay that ruling until the D.C. Circuit has a chance to weigh in, because otherwise, you know, that there's no practical relief the D.C. Circuit can give you if it turns out we got it wrong. And all of these, right, again, and as you flagged, we're speculating as to what the arguments would be, but these are not Alina Haba, Sidney Powell level arguments. These are colorable arguments, and you want to preserve a litigant's right to make those arguments and get a real appeal. That makes sense, even if I don't like it.
You know, this is not something which is brand new either. We've talked about this here because Lindsey Graham litigated the very same issue before, was it the 11th Circuit? He in Georgia for the special purpose grand jury, he litigated this and he kind of got a partial win. So it's not a totally crazy thing, but he didn't get a full win either.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And Judge Howell did give the DOJ access to some emails between Perry and Coups for Dummy lawyers John Eastman, Ken Klukowski, and Jeff Clark. And I'm so glad we get to talk about this.
Love that.
Speaking of Jeff Clark, he has also come before Judge Howell on an issue I covered at Above the Law in December, and I would just like to take a minute to explain it to you because I loved it so much. This dingus wrote his memoirs on Google Note, auto-saving a copy and emailing it to himself every day. And it had a notation.
Did he also print out a copy every day?
I mean, probably. Christ. Anyway, it had a notation.
What happens if the Google loses it? I'm sorry. Please continue.
Yeah. It had a notation on it explicitly saying, none of this is privileged, I guess because he isn't it? I don't know. He's an idiot. Whatever. The day after he got subpoenaed, he added another notation that actually it was all work product.
Yeah. So none of it is privilege, right? Like, so when you talk about attorney-client privilege, it falls into two categories. And put a pin in this because it's going to come up in the B segment. You think of attorney-client communications, right? I ask my lawyer, hey, what happens if I do X? The lawyer says, you'll get arrested. I say, okay, I'm not going to do X anymore. Classic attorney-client communications, right? But also, sometimes you will say to your attorney, hey, can you prepare something? Or, you know, let's get ready for trial. And even though you haven't specifically asked for it, like, it's the attorney's job to do things, right? To write memoranda, to write motions in lemonade, all that sort of good stuff. The key test when an attorney does something without sort of that direct communicative aspect is, was the attorney's work product prepared in anticipation of or in connection with litigation? And so that is, I mean, and this has been litigated thousands of times. So when you're writing your memoirs, you are not writing those in anticipation of litigation. There's just zero argument that this is a slam dunk. No, it isn't, Jeff. Well, this is why you don't do, you know, this is why we'll call you if there's an oil spill.
Right. Well, so Clark's lawyer, Charles Burnham, you remember Charles Burnham?
Oh, yeah. he's on a big win streak. You know, he did get that one win in front of Eileen Cannon, Federalist Society weirdo, but that feels like a Harlem Globetrotters versus the Washington Generals kind of thing. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Our buddy Charlie had an alternate theory as to why prosecutors could not subpoena Clark's no doubt gripping autobiography, and it was that this biography was attorney-client privileged. Now, you may be scratching your head, but see, Clark is a lawyer, and also he was his own client, ipso facto propter hoc, attorney-client privilege. What do you think?
I am just reminded of that fantastic line from one of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books that was like, the problem with talking to yourself is that about half the time you know what you're going to say.
Yeah. So you will be shocked to know that none of these arguments managed to persuade Judge Howell. But thank you for allowing me to revisit one of the stories that make my heart sing with joy.
Oh, gosh. Anytime.
Yeah. So there were a few other orders handed down, including one telling Wingnut Zelig Cash Patel that you don't get to plead the fifth once you've been immunized, jackass. I mean, Okay. Presumably, Judge Howell did not put it that way. The jackasses imply.
I would give any amount of money if she did, yeah.
Particularly since Patel himself is a lawyer, and he should know. I believe that one was before the documents grand jury, since Patel spent several weeks running his mouth on right-wing media to say that Trump declassified all the purloined documents via, I don't know, transubstantiation, or he laid his hands on whatever, like, bullshit theory was. Anyway, clearly that's not going to be the end of the story. There will be other grand juries. Mike Pence's Spitzer DeVate or Mark Meadows and probably O'Brien as well. So yeah. This ain't over. And we're not over either, but just, like, hang tight. We're going to have an ad and we will be right back.
And we're back from the break and moving on to our B story, even though, spoiler alert, it's still about Donald Trump. It is still about Jack Smith's grand jury. I have a feeling we're going to be on this story for quite a while, at least until the summer.
So it appears we will. And the Times is now reporting, and The Guardian has confirmed, that three of Trump's personal lawyers have now testified under subpoena to the grand jury investigating Trump's documents, which is wild.
Yeah.
According to the Times, Evan the Cork Corcoran, Christina Bob, and fan favorite Alina Hobb were all hauled in to say what they knew.
Yeah. And so if you're wondering, hey, is it usual for your lawyer to be subpoenaed to testify against you? The answer is obviously not, right? Notwithstanding Donald Trump's nonsensical belief that having a lawyer in the room brings down the cone of silence. I mean, like, that's not true. But attorney-client privilege still exists, right? Even for Donald Trump, the stuff you tell your lawyer is generally not stuff you anticipate them running to go tell a grand jury so that that grand jury can then use your lawyer's information to indict you.
I have heard that there are exceptions. I don't know, something about John Eastman maybe trying to do crimes and coups. I don't know.
Fair, right? So obviously there are exceptions. And so for this segment, I thought we would take a deep dive into, you know, when privilege is not privilege. And you absolutely foreshadowed this. We're going to cover three areas. We're going to cover, number one, things that are outside the privilege. Number two, waiver. And number three, everyone's favorite John Eastman crime fraud exception.
That is also a fan favorite.
We need a, like, you know, NCAA style bracket to, like, pair off. I don't know who would be the number one seed, but we got a lot of fan favorites in here.
I feel like Donald Trump is the number one seed. Crime fraud.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so this is going to weave together all three of your stories and hopefully kind of give the legal context. So first. And this is maybe the most obvious, but I think a lot of people are not talking about it, particularly in the press, is when your lawyer isn't acting as your lawyer. And again, this is really obvious to a lot of OA listeners because it is just the logical converse of what we made fun of Donald Trump for 30 seconds ago, right? Bringing a lawyer into the room doesn't make everything privileged. Otherwise, you know, there'd be a lot more lawyers sitting in on, you know, mob planning, right? Like, so what kind of stuff might not be privileged?
Right. And
interestingly, the rule that governs this in federal court is Federal Rule of Evidence, Rule 501. And it used to have this long laundry list, like the kind of textualist, let's specify everything of what's privileged and what isn't. And then in 1975, the lawyers changed that to where it is today, right? It's remained substantively unchanged for another half century. And it just says this. The common law, as interpreted by United States court in light of reason and experience, governs a claim of privilege. That doesn't sound very, originalist to me, but
right.
Unless, of course, you know, otherwise provided in the Constitution by a law or by specific rules made by the Supreme Court. But the baseline rule is, let's look at 13th century Saxony.
Oh, are you kidding? You and 13th century Saxony. I'm going to send you back to that dungeon. All right, go on.
Okay. Again, I always think it's worth pointing out when you've got the option to go with a specific defined list, lawyers of all political persuasions got together and chose common law. And the second you start to parse that, you understand exactly why we would do that, right? So, for example, today, 2023, if I hold up a document to show my client over a Zoom call or I share out my screen, that's obviously privileged. We know that.
Right.
But if you were writing a list in 1975, your list might not have been written broadly enough to include that. Because in 1975, like, the person writing the list would be thinking, oh, how do people interact with their lawyers? They can go into the lawyer's office or they can call them on the phone. And so you might have had something like, you know, handed to you or audio, you know, right? Like, you wouldn't have been thinking we have instant visual communications across the globe. So I get that. Bit of a tangent.
Bit of a tangent. Not you.
All right. But look, that old-timey rule from 13th century Saxony is still the principle that we use today, right? When you're talking to your lawyer about lawyer stuff, we kind of throw a huge blanket over everything and call it privilege because we want people to be fully honest with their lawyers. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking to your lawyer about non-lawyer stuff, that's fair game. And that brings us to your second favorite Trump lawyer, former OAN talking head Christina Bob.
I mean, she's terrific, but I'm not sure that she's my second. Like, first of all, there's like a whole bracket and she's not in the top five. I'm going to be honest with you. And okay. Second of all, I know that she is technically a lawyer, but like, what is she? She never like enters her appearance on anything. Like, is she functioning as a lawyer?
I think she was on some of the Florida pleadings before.
No, you're confusing
Judge
her
Cannon.
With Lindsay Halligan. Nope,
that's Lindsay
Halligan.
You're right. You are correct. I rescind that. I don't know.
I don't think she puts her name on things.
Yeah.
I mean, except for like when she puts her name on things and like lives to regret it immediately.
Yeah, right. You should. Yeah. So as you allude to, Christina Bob has a real problem, and that problem begins with the fact that she has very publicly stated on multiple occasions, including, you know, not just it's been sneakily coerced out of her by those crazy liberals at CNN, but to friendly right wing press like the Right Side Broadcasting Network. And, you know, add that to the list of stuff I'm never watching. That when it came to the document side of this case, right, the Mar-a-Lago documents, she was not hired as and was not acting as a lawyer. She said that. She says, I was acting as the custodian of documents, right? It was my job to know where the documents were. And that's why Evan the Cork drafted the certification, but she signed it, right?
That was so sleazy.
But
yeah,
it so 100% was. But you can understand it if you replace all the names of people here with actual humans, right? Like if I were outside counsel for an organization, I would not let the document custodian write up the certification. I'd write up the certification, right? I'm the lawyer and then the non-lawyer signs it. So there is a non-malicious way of interpreting it. But again, I'm having to do backflips here.
Yeah, I mean, there is a non-malicious way of interpreting it, but that's not how I interpret it. I think she has practiced law in some capacity, but before she was Trump's whatever, custodian of documents or, you know, whatever she is, she was a One America news host.
Right.
And she spends most of her time that I can tell, like, going on television and I don't know. It's funny. Her great star turn was getting yelled at by Laura Ingraham when they didn't do anything after the raid. And, like, she got so reamed out by Laura Ingraham that that's why they filed that case in front of Judge Cannon. She's not, like, the brightest bulb in the bunch.
Yeah. True story. One of my former partners is next door neighbors with Laura Ingraham. And this is part of why I was not well suited for life in a big firm, because every time we got together at partners meeting, I was like, have you left a flaming bag of dog poop on your neighbor's door yet? And the answer was no. And I stopped going to a lot of those meetings. Anyway.
You know what my mother does? My mother was a partner. She just retired for like 50 years, but she was a partner for about 40 years in a big law firm.
Yeah, she's a trailblazer, yeah.
She's crazy. Amazing. Amazing, amazing. And she would knit baby sweaters in partners meetings every single time. God bless.
I adore that. That is so – okay, we're going to put a big old knitting needle pin in that one because I want to
revisit
that.
You're putting a pin in my mom?
Not your mom in the story. Gosh.
Sure, okay.
Anyway, we were talking about Evan the Cork drafting the certification – Christina Bob signing it. And here's the thing. When you say I'm not acting as a lawyer, I am acting as a custodian of records. You can subpoena a document custodian and ask them questions. There's no custodian client privilege, right? And she has lawyered up and is apparently, I would put sarcastic quotes around cooperating, but cooperating with Jack Smith's grand jury. And no matter what, that can't be good news for Trump.
No, it's certainly not good news for Trump. She was there. She was there for a lot of things, right? She was there when they did the raid. She was there when I'm sorry, there were a lot of scare quotes around that. But on August 8th, when the FBI executed the search warrant, she was there for that. She was there for a bunch of other kind of planning about these documents things. And if she has already said, I'm not acting as a lawyer, she's got no privilege.
Yeah.
On the plus side, maybe she won't. She's so ditzy, maybe she won't remember what happened.
On the plus side for Trump, not for
that's
justice
what I'm
and humanity.
That's what I'm saying, right.
Okay, so that's one way in which your lawyer can wind up testifying against you if you have hired them not to do law stuff. Mm-hmm. The next way that your lawyer can wind up testifying against you is if you've waived the privilege. And there are a bunch of subcategories of this. Like, one of the ways in which a client does that is by talking about what they've told their lawyer, or alternatively and worse, what their lawyer has told them in public, right? And mm-hmm. and the second you think about that, that makes perfect sense. Otherwise, everything you told your lawyer, you could then selectively present in court, right? Like, you could just say, oh, I told my lawyer X, and then there would be no opportunity for anybody to really test the veracity of that story, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that waives the privilege. But there's another way in which you can waive the privilege. And I think that ties into a particularly weird story in the New York Times about Boris Epstein that you and I were trying to puzzle out for a long time.
Yeah, this was buried halfway down in the article that mentioned that Corcoran went before the grand jury. And it also noted that Smith's prosecutors have been asking witnesses a lot of questions about Boris Epstein. I'm not sure that everybody knows Boris Epstein. You're perhaps not, you know, in the MAGA comic universe, you have to be pretty steeped in the lore. But Epstein is, I mean, he's kind of a fixer. I guess he would say he's like the season 5 Michael Cohen character, maybe okay. A little better. I mean, he did go to Georgetown. He's like a little better educated and you know, has nicer suits. He doesn't look like he mugged Secretariat for his sport jacket. But he is he's all the way up in all of these things. He's got, you know, he was sending email. I mean, he's not like the brightest bulb in the bunch either. He was sending all of these emails talking about the fake electors scheme and using the word fake. And right. he's apparently the one that introduced Evan Corcoran to Donald Trump. And he's the one that, when they were talking about privilege, they were trying to get all of those attorneys that we talked about before to assert privilege. Eric Hirschman, you know, frenemy of the pod, was the one that said, like,
Justice Bat Eric Hirschman.
Yeah. 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 I'm not taking legal advice from you or from Boris, who, to be fair, I think is an idiot. And like, I also think he's an idiot and would not take legal advice from Boris. So apparently Boris is an object of great interest to the special counsel. And like, that's not a position you want to be in, especially if you have a tendency to run your mouth.
Yeah, I think that's right. I sort of view Boris as occupying the Rudy Giuliani role now. Right. Like, sort of.
No.
Only
Rudy Giuliani
is Ukrainian collaborators.
I mean, yeah, Rudy Giuliani is like a has been. I mean, Boris is like a never was. Yes, he did. I think he got pushed out of the Trump administration, although maybe he left, you know, on his own terms. I believe he worked in the White House for a little while, and then he went and worked for Sinclair Broadcasting. But he's got this kind of like thuggish look. I mean, he's not. No. He's not Rudy Giuliani. I mean, Rudy Giuliani was something, and everybody who kind of treats him the way that they treat him because they remember what he was.
Fair. I did not mean as in terms of having credentials. Gosh, and that's weird to say about, you know, drunken, flatulent, decomposing Rudy Giuliani. But I mean in terms of sort of being at the center of coordinating all of the quasi-legal stuff. But in any event. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your point well taken.
The thing we were trying to figure out, though, like to get back to it, there are apparently the prosecutors are trying to chase down some plot by our buddy Boris to orchestrate a common interest privilege in the documents case. And you and I were trying to figure out what they meant by this. Were they talking about a joint defense agreement? Were they really talking about a common interest privilege? So maybe you want to break that down for the listeners.
Yeah. So here's, and again, a lot of supposing going on, but all of a sudden when you see this odd legal term pop up without context in an article where the New York Times is, you know, presumably quoting from sources that know what they're talking about. And, you know, the fact that the person writing the article doesn't know what the common interest privilege is gives a lot of credibility to that. So here's what it means. While it's not true that having a lawyer in the room means everything said is privileged, right? We just made fun of that position. The opposite of that kind of is true, right? If you have a conversation with your lawyer and there is even one other person in the room that isn't the client or the lawyer, that absolutely waives the privilege, right?
Right.
So the idea, right. Yeah, the idea is that you as the client have no intent to keep something confidential if you're willing to say it in front of somebody else, right?
Right.
So what counts as other people is obviously where this gets litigated. So obviously, you know, an assistant comes into the room, the associate comes, that's not legally speaking another person, right? If you're a party to the litigation, if you're an employee of a party, if you're otherwise engaged by the lawyer, you know, you're not an outsider.
Right.
But let's say you're a political supporter of a former president. Or let's say you represent the former president in another matter that may be pending in front of a different grand jury. You are an outsider. And so,
Alina, you are an outsider, Alina.
And so the question here is, did Boris maybe let too many people into the room or, you know, have too many CCs on his emails?
That would be pretty par for the course, considering the emails that he sent to like 15 people about the fake elector scheme. And that would really be par for Trump world, too. I mean, I feel like I've been watching, you know, 12 seasons of this show. It's like The Simpsons. But Don Jr. was constantly telling Robert Mueller, like, no, there was a lawyer in the room when I had this conversation with, you know, three other people. And so it's privileged. And you know, he always had a magic security blanket of privilege.
Yeah, no, that I had forgotten that made its way into volume one of the Mueller report. That's just, again, more evidence of the, you know, crazy way these people operate. So, again, we're speculating based on a sentence in a New York Times article. But if it's the case that prosecutors are asking witnesses before the grand jury about Boris Epstein and common interest privilege, then we might infer that Boris's answer would have been, oh, hey, looks like a bunch of unrelated people in the room that would or on the email that would break privilege. But really, what you have is people with a common defense privilege.
Okay. So this is where we were confused, right?
Yes.
Because it kind of looks like what they're talking about might be a joint defense agreement. And that is very par for, right? That is something that happened in the Mueller investigation too. All of the witnesses kind of said, well, we're in a joint defense agreement, so we get to share everything. I mean, even Rudy Giuliani, remember with that, and Robert Costello, like it's all the same characters. They just go over and over and over again. It's like General Hospital. Everybody's going to be married to everybody by the end of the show.
Amnesia. Anyway.
Yeah. And not just Rudy. Rudy kind of allegedly dangled a pardon to Michael Cohen via this weird kind of to keep him on side in the joint defense agreement when Michael Cohen flipped for Robert Mueller. So it's all the same. It's just like the same echo. And yeah. So I think that I'm not sure what they're talking about here.
Okay. Here's what I think I've kind of figured out here's what I think makes sense as part of our speculation, right? Mm-hmm. A common defense privilege is more broad than a joint defense agreement, but it is the underlying privilege that makes a joint defense agreement possible. A joint defense agreement would absolutely be written down. And if there's one thing we know about Trump and his cronies, they abhor writing stuff down, right?
real lawyers don't take notes.
Right. And so you do not have, the case law is super clear on this, we both had to look it up, that you do not have to have a written agreement for an assertion of common defense privilege to be enforceable. You do need an express agreement, but it can be an express verbal agreement by and among all the parties and their counsel that, yes, you're working together on a particular matter. And the common law on this goes all the way back to 1872.
Well, let's stay out of the dungeon on this one, shall we?
Okay. All right. So a modern example, right? But nevertheless, well-established common law. Think about it this way. Suppose there are two identical twin brothers, right? We stick with the General Hospital theme here. Yeah. I love this, right? So twins, okay. Identical twins, each of whom is the primary suspect in a murder investigation, right?
Uh-huh.
So the eyewitness testimony isn't going to be particularly useful because they're identical, right? Now, no attorney in the universe would represent both of those brothers. That would be an insuperable conflict of interest. Yeah.
You need two identical twin attorneys.
We are putting together a fantastic movie, and I've got a great twist for you. Okay. So, insuperable conflict of interest. You can't represent them both because the primary defense, right, the primary way in which you're going to establish reasonable doubt on the eyewitness testimony is brother number one is going to say, it wasn't me, it was brother number two. And brother number two is going to say, it wasn't me, it was brother number one. And you could imagine a situation if they were tried sequentially in which two separate juries, you know, said passed on brother number one and then passed on brother number two because they had reasonable doubt, you know, created by that. This, I think, would make for a good movie. So
I feel like Nicolas Cage and John Travolta are in this movie.
We're rewriting Face Off. This is fantastic. Okay. So nevertheless, brother number one has to get his own lawyer. Brother number two has to get his own lawyer. But both brothers, because they are adverse, but both brothers do have a common interest in sharing lots of other exculpatory evidence, right? So suppose there's a potential problem with the chain of custody of the murder weapon, for example, right? Like that would benefit both brothers. So you might have a joint defense agreement that says, hey, when we have stuff that is exculpatory for both of us, we can get together and share and strategize. And our lawyers can say, hey, the government's told me X. What's the government told? And that's not going to break privilege, even though we might be adverse in other ways.
Yeah. Luckily, the Trump administration would never, or the MAGA world would never abuse this to say, get eyes on all kinds of grand jury testimony, especially like if they paid for, if like the PAC would pay everybody's lawyers and then everybody would stay on side and share all the testimony.
Yeah.
That would never happen.
Or to bring everybody in the same room and make sure that they all rehearse their testimony together. Yeah, that would never. And make sure that, 26-year-old staffers get saddled with lawyers that force them to say things that are contrary to their self-interest. Yeah, exactly. Right. Never would never happen. So, but this principle, right? Common defense privilege applies both to attorney-client communications and also to work product, right? So if I write a memo for brother number one explaining how to cross-examine the prosecution's key police witness, I can hand that to you and you can use that to defend brother number two. And specifically in the D.C. Circuit, right? And D.C. is where all of this stuff is going to get litigated, right? The lead case is a case called In Re Sealed Case. It is 29 F3rd 715. This is from 1994. And it sets out the three elements that a party asserting the common defense privilege needs to show. So in this case, Boris would have the burden of proof to show, number one, that these communications were made in furtherance of a joint defense effort. That two, the statements were designed to further that effort. And you could see how those are two separate things. There must be a joint defense effort and the statements must advance that. And number three, that the privilege was not waived. Because again, if anybody doesn't share that interest and is present in the room, that would operate as a waiver.
Okay. I would imagine that this is also the kind of thing that gets raised pretextually, though. not that anybody in MAGA world would make a pretextual defense. But after the fact, when you have in fact waived attorney-client privilege by like running your mouth and inviting too many people in the room or like CCing everybody, and you're desperately hoping to like hide it from the court, is that a possibility?
Yeah, that happens a lot. And courts are reasonably smart about that. And so that has three implications here, right? So first, courts construe this defense very, very narrowly. That means they err on the side of disclosure. Right? Second, courts typically require some evidence that there was, in fact, a joint defense effort. Again, in D.C., doesn't have to be an agreement in writing. But since that is the typical practice, you would probably have to explain why there wasn't a written joint defense agreement in this case, if you were to assert that. And then third, it means, and this is, I think, by far the most significant, that courts really do scrutinize whether parties have a joint interest or not. So they will look into the merits of that assertion. Just saying, we all got together, we all agreed that we have a joint interest, that's not enough.
Okay.
You must have an actual legal objective shared interest. And we're going to talk about that in a second. So let me give you another hypothetical situation with participants that we will call Donald Trump, Boris Epstein, Evan the Cork, Christina Bob, and Christina Bob's lawyer, who shall remain nameless.
No. Christina Bob's lawyer is named John Laro, Lena Haba's lawyer. Yep.
That's an interesting niche. Everybody has to have a market for their practice. Okay. So These five people are in the room. And the subject is the false declaration that Evan the Cork drafted and Christina Bob signed. That
hypothetically.
Yeah, attesting falsely that they had turned over all the classified documents to the Department of Justice, when in fact they had dozens of boxes of classified documents in the pool shed. In that hypothetical, it would be very difficult to know what possible common interest there could be between Trump and his lawyers and Bob and Laro, right? Because everything that that exculpates Bob inculpates Trump, and vice versa, right? If it's good for one, it's bad for the other.
Right. They have adverse interests, because if she says, I didn't know, I didn't, you know, and it also inculpates Corcoran.
Yep.
Right. If she says, I didn't know that this was a false declaration and this guy made me sign it. I mean, they've all put their name on things that said, you know, either verbally or in writing, that said, we looked and there was nothing else here. So, yeah, nobody here has common interest. It's going to be hard to establish privity.
I think that's right. And the case to which I would analogize it is, there was relatively recent litigation regarding the sale of Otto, which was a small rideshare company. It was a competitor to Uber. You know what Uber is, right? And so that was meant rhetorically. So look, Otto and Uber had a written joint defense agreement in which they shared a bunch of confidential information about the market for ride sharing. But Waymo, which you might imagine had an interest and could, you know, wanted to get its hands on that confidential information, challenged that in court. And the court sided with Waymo, right? The court reasoned that when you're selling Otto to Uber, you cannot have a common legal interest, because whatever benefits one side drives that price either up or down. And, you know, it's in Otto's interest to sell for as much as possible. It's in Uber's interest to buy it for as little as possible. And so, notwithstanding the fact that you guys came together and said, we have a joint interest, no, you don't. And the court ordered the disclosure of that confidential information.
Okay. I understand what you are saying. That makes complete sense. Although I think it is terrible public policy to have that parties cannot negotiate honestly in a sale. That, you know, doesn't this look, this is neither here nor there for the purposes of this discussion, but wouldn't that incentivize lying? We should have an efficient market. An efficient market like should be where Uber should be able to buy Otto, and that they should both, you know, be able to be candid with each other. I mean, I understand, neither here nor there for the purposes of this argument, but thanks. I hate it.
No, I love that. I think the workaround that I would do if you wanted to have a friendly sale between Otto and Uber is to put all of the information into letters that then say they are privileged and confidential and represent settlement negotiations, right? And
right.
Sort of put that header on it. And courts are pretty expansive in terms of allowing a party to keep that confidential and also under seal if the subject is, you know, if the subject matter would be. So you would stick them in a settlement letter and you would have an agreed upon protective order that says, we agree that these are confidential business matters. And then you could also have, you know, a destruction policy at the end. So I think there's a workaround, but I love the way you're thinking about that.
Right. But okay, we've gone a little bit far afield. Let's go back to Boris and too many people at the party running their mouths.
Yeah, that's right. So again, we're doing a lot of reading between the lines here, but that's what immediately went through my head when I saw that reference to a common interest privilege. Made me think that their documents, in particular that Boris has sent to a whole lot of people, because as you point out, that's what he does, that he has then labeled on a privilege log and refused to produce on the grounds of a common interest privilege. And as we have broken down, if that is the case, a lot of supposition, I think there is a good chance that Jack Smith is going to convince a court that there is not, in fact, a common interest privilege, that, you know, there's a prima facie case to show that that privilege was waived by disclosure to third parties. The burden would then shift to Boris to meet those three criteria. And I'm skeptical of his ability to do so. So I'm out here on the limb, but I'm comfortable. It's a big, thick, sturdy limb.
And you know what? Jack Smith's record has been really good with Judge Beryl Howell. I mean, she is stepping down pretty soon, but the record is, you know, he's gotten everything that he wanted pretty much.
I think that's right. Okay. And as usual, I have the largest chunk of this. I hope our listeners don't think that it's a bait and switch. We're crossing the hour mark, and I want to share that deep dive on the crime fraud exception, but I guess we're going to have to push that forward to Monday's show. But sneak peek, there was a New York Times story that also implicated crime fraud.
Okay, so we apologize for talking so much about Waymo and Uber that we didn't get to finish, but we'll bring it to you. We'll get it to you.
Yeah, and with that in mind, we're going to bring episode 693 of Opening Arguments to a close. Again, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting the show. And we will see you on Monday.
Bye, guys.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Liz. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, with assistance from Teresa Gomez and Deborah Smith.
Opening Arguments is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, copyright 2023, all rights reserved.